We're starting our Lent series today. Today is the first Sunday of Lent. Many of you, I'm sure, came to the Ash Wednesday service this past Wednesday. So today's first Sunday of Lent. And our theme for this series is creating safe space. And we're really addressing the reality that we want to share God's love with the world, right? We want to make the world a better place. We want to bring life to the world as followers of Jesus. And, you know, one approach to that could be to just, you know, recruit people to our ideas, our beliefs, our way. And this series, I think, is going to put out perhaps another way of thinking about it, which is, what if we were to become purveyors of safe space? What if we were people who created space around us at work, at home, in our neighborhoods, in our families, that felt safe and where people could truly be themselves and work on their own issues and journey with us together. So we're going to be exploring that over the next several weeks. Today is kind of introductory, but I wanted to just look at a couple of issues before we get into today's message. The first one is this. The world really doesn't feel very safe, right? And I think we've experienced something this past week which has been all too familiar to us, which is another shooting, another tragedy, another act of unbelievable violence, and it has a huge impact on us as observers of that, let alone the impact on that community and on the victims and the victims' families. So we're just going to spend a moment in silent prayer here, just for a couple of minutes, to address that in our own way. We'll just stay seated for this. So we'll have a moment of silence where we can, I'd encourage you to do maybe two things. One is just to cry out to God in your own way about this situation. And the other would be to hold the people involved there in God's love, just to sort of hold them there in this this ocean of love that we've been talking about recently. And I think it's helpful to think about this for ourselves too, right? We don't want to make it all about us. But I think these things become increasingly traumatic. And part of the problem is we see them so closely. You know, there was a day when things like this were reported. Now we almost get to experience them because of social media and smartphone technology and all that kind of stuff. And I think it's unbelievably traumatic. So I think we need to take care of ourselves as well. And I'd encourage you, to use this prayer time we're going to have in a moment for that. Just to sort of open your own heart to God and your own need for healing, your own need for God's love. But also to process that with people you know, people who care about you, people who that would feel safe with, where we can process some of that trauma. I think it's very easy for us to move on, right? We almost have to just to cope. But these things end up being cumulative and sort of weigh down on us. So in some ways, just addressing this one issue, this incident this past week, in some ways, is kind of addressing so many things that have happened over the past few years, right? So let's just hold some silence, and then I'll close us out. Maybe we could just put the lights down a little bit. I'll close us out with a brief prayer, but let's just take a couple of minutes. Lord, we cry out to you. Lord, have mercy. Lord, in all the horror, the confusion, the anger, the despair, Lord, may you be real. May your love, your incarnate love, be real for those who are suffering right now with such loss. And we hold them in your love. And Lord, we pray that you, God, would help us, that your love might flow through us, that even though at times it seems so dark, that we would never give up hope, never give up being bearers of light, bearers of your love, bearers of your kindness. And with all that, Lord, we just ask that you would heal our own hearts, that we would be able to share healing with others. We just acknowledge that we are caught up in all this too. So here we are. Receive us, we pray. Amen. Okay, thanks so much for doing that. Another thing we're going to be doing throughout this series is kind of looking at and highlighting some of the ways in which we are endeavoring to be and bring safe space to others, and you know, within our community and without our community. We want to highlight some of the things that we're doing as a church. So each week, as part of the message and in other parts of the service, we'll be hearing from different people. In a second, Mara is going to come up and share it with us about what we're doing in Guatemala. There's a couple of aspects to this. One is just sort of sharing some of the great things that are happening, some of the needs that, you know, there'll be things shared that you can pray about. And we also want to highlight the giving aspect of it. So, you know, these are areas where it's kind of like our tithe dollars in action, if you like. And as a focus for Lent, too, we want to think, you know, Lent is a time where we think about self-discipline and, you know, examining kind of where we're at and commitments we've made in the past and reevaluating those commitments. And obviously, giving is a big part of that in terms of our spiritual journey and being part of a community here. So we're hoping these will be reminders and also an inspiration to continue giving in a really generous way, especially as we go out through the course of Lent. So Mara's going to come up and just share with us. Let's give her a really warm welcome. Come on, Mara.
Good morning. Can everybody hear me? Well, I'm so pleased to be here on behalf of the Guatemala team, the Guatemala ministry. Normally, you associate me with the in the translator role, but one of the things that I also do is I am the keeper of the scholarship data. So that puts me very close to the work we do with the scholarship program. The scholarship program is a real game changer for the people in Ipala. And the bulk of our funds that go for projects really go to support scholarships. This is something that the community there has clamored for. We have 60 scholarships. We fund students in grades 7 through 12. And in 2016, we graduated 7 students. In 2017, which just finished in October, we graduated 11 students, 6 from the Catholic school and 5 from the Cedar-supported schools that we interact with in Ipala. So today, I just want to bring this down a notch and bring it, make it more real to you by introducing some of the students that graduated this past October. And we're going to talk about three students and their stories, if you will. All of these graduated just in October, and they're from the community of Las Colinas. And for those who have been there, you know where Las Colinas is. It's a modest neighborhood close to the hotel where we stay. So where are they now? And I want to tell you the story of Vinicio. So here's Vinicio, and he is standing with the gray shirt behind sort of at the middle, a little bit to your left, and he is one of our graduates, and he's pictured there with his family. Now, Vinicio graduated from what we call the Diversificado program, and what that means is that it's kind of like vocational level, business administration and accounting track, if you will, that is offered in high school there. Because again, they're trying to pack a lot in and get people prepared after high school to be able to earn their living. So there's Vinicio pictured with his family, and I, at the far right is his father, Don Francisco. His mother is, she's really kind of tiny. She's right next to the person holding, the sibling holding the sign in the pink. But that's her right there to Vinicio's left. Her name is Doña Xiomara. And this is a story of a family, because without the family's support, they're not able to really excel. And it really reminds me of how it takes a village to really make the future happen for many people, and that we're part of that family too. We're part of the global family and the global village that's making a reality for Vinicio. So I was very, very impressed with the family. It's almost like I fell in love with the family along with Vinicio, because his father was always present. He always showed up. And this is a person who is very modest. They have very modest living, but they have so much pride, so much joy, so much dignity. And whenever we had an activity, Vinicio's father was there front and center. He always showed up. And that really, really meant a lot to me, because I can't even put into words, there's no words that can express the feelings of gratefulness and the pride that I was able to experience through Don Francisco. It's just very transformative, and you know, something that I will always carry with me. But Vinicio will make a big difference. He's currently looking for a job, so we expect great things from him, and his family is so proud, because these are firsts. A lot of the work we're doing here in Ipala is allowing people to go to school and complete high school for the first time. The next person I'd like to highlight is Catherine. And Catherine just graduated. She completed what's called bachillerato, which is kind of like a two-year high school program that prepares. It's more of a general education, and it prepares people to go to college. And she's a great student. She has a love of law enforcement and military, and she just became a cadet. She is working in the police academy as a cadet, and so that will lead her to a job in law enforcement, and that's considered a pretty good job in Guatemala, because it has like benefits, etc. But in addition to that, if she wanted to go to university, she could still do that even once she becomes a police officer. So again, these are opportunities that open many doors. I was really struck with Catherine's family. I met her mother. She has a single parent, and she works harvesting melons and tomatoes. And I was struck by her brother, because Her brother, by all accounts, was a very good student, and he wasn't able to continue his studies. And so she presents a lot of hope for the family because she's able to do something that others cannot do. And then here's Robin. You can see Robin is marching down at his graduation. He was an honor student, and he is a great leader. He's very motivated. As a matter of fact, during his high school years, he has interest in culinary arts, and he became a pastry chef, and he's very entrepreneurial. And this is something where people are always looking for ways to help their skill set and make money. He is enrolled in a private college called Galileo University. It's a weekend program because that's the model there. He's looking for work, and he has some promising leads. He also studied the same track as Vinicio, the diversificado. So we expect really wonderful things coming from Robin as well. And all of this happens because of what you do, because you make a difference. We all make a difference through our giving, providing hope for these families. It's a real game changer. It's something that, you know, it's an investment, and it's a long-term commitment. And so in the words of one of Vinicio's family members, life is hard in Ipala, but your help is making it a little bit easier. So I encourage you to keep them in your prayers. We know they definitely keep this whole community in their prayers, and ask you to continue to support the programs that we have for scholarships. In addition to that, we have a team that goes every summer to Ipala. And this summer we'll have a team of middle schoolers and high schoolers and adults. And there will be an informational meeting after the service in the barn. And I encourage anyone here who would like to learn more about how to really be there and participate and just experience for yourselves the wonderful, how God is working there and love in action and how we make a difference day to day. God bless you.
Thank you. That was great. Thank you so much for giving us that information. So, creating safe space. We're beginning our Lent series today, as I was saying. And Lent is this season of self-reflection, self-examination, sort of a tradition in many branches of the Christian church. And we observe it every year here at Cedar Ridge. It lasts for 40 days. And, you know, sort of, you know, there's some variations there. Some technicalities about Sundays and that kind of thing, but basically it's 40 days, and we get that from the story about Jesus spending 40 days and nights in the wilderness, in the desert. That story itself may be sort of told in a certain way to allude to the 40 years that the people of Israel spent in the wilderness. So Lent is this wilderness experience. So let's just look at that passage. We're going to look at it from Mark. It's a nice short version of this story of Jesus going into the wilderness. It says this: at that time, Jesus came from Nazareth in Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. Just as Jesus was coming up out of the water, he saw heaven being torn open and the Spirit descending on him like a dove. And a voice came from heaven: "You are my Son, whom I love. With you I am well pleased." We looked at that passage a few weeks ago when we were talking about God's love. At once the Spirit sent him out into the wilderness, and he was in the wilderness for 40 days, being tempted by Satan. He was with the wild animals, and angels attended him. That's all Mark says about it. You know, in Matthew and Luke, you get a lot of information about the kind of temptation that Jesus went through. It's quite a compelling story, but that's very brief there from Mark. And I want to just pull out a couple of aspects from that text there to address some themes that will be good for us, I think, to take throughout this series, to take on this journey through Lent together. And then we'll talk about one or two other things that are sort of introductory, but would, I think, are good things to carry through. And we'll end up by just chatting a little bit about what to expect over the next few weeks and ways you can engage and get involved, because it's going to be a little different this time round to previous Lents. Couple of aspects on this passage. The first one is this: it's a wilderness experience, right? Jesus goes into the wilderness. And the word there, actually, it says he was sent into the wilderness. The word there in the Greek, it's a word called ekbalo, which means thrown. And it's the same word that is used when Jesus cast out evil spirits. It's kind of a somewhat violent word. So there's this sense that Jesus, maybe in Mark's version anyway, doesn't necessarily sort of go submissively and willingly into the wilderness, but it's kind of thrown in there. And there's a certain level of discomfort about that, right? And I think we get that the wilderness is an uncomfortable place. We've spent most of our history as human beings trying to tame the wilderness or avoid it. You know, we've developed technologies to control it and, you know, make our lives more predictable and comfortable. And the wilderness, in some sense, is an uncomfortable, scary place. So if Lent is this season where we go into the wilderness intentionally, to some degree, we're saying yes to discomfort. And I think right up front here, it's important for us to distinguish between safe space and comfortable space, right? Those are not the same things. In fact, if we create safe space for ourselves, you know, we're going to be talking about all those kind of things throughout this series. Safe space for ourselves to be our true selves. Creating safe space for other people around us. Creating safe space for people who maybe aren't around us but we know don't feel safe. As we think about all those things, that is going to result in a certain level of discomfort. Because, for instance, if we make safe space around us for other people, then there's an opportunity for people to really be themselves, and that might feel very uncomfortable. If we do create safe space for ourselves and do the inner work that's required to really be our true selves, that's not going to be, it's probably not going to be painless, right? And that's because we get into sort of safe or comfortable, let's say, habits and ways of doing things. Just as we, as humanity, have tried to tame the wilderness, so we kind of try to tame the wilderness of our own lives. We develop safety mechanisms and defense mechanisms and patterns of behavior that we may be aware of or may not be aware of that become very comfortable to us. I've shared here before that I've struggled pretty much my whole life with anxiety, and that sort of manifests itself in different ways. Sometimes it can feel quite disabling. Most of the time, it's just an ongoing struggle. But a little while ago, I was struggling with some things. I had to go and see a therapist, and I didn't have to. I chose to. Willingly went into the wilderness. But through help, was able to see some patterns in my own life that I wasn't really aware of, ways of interacting, ways of thinking, ways of behaving, that had become so normal to me that I just thought that, well, that's how it is. And when you become aware of some of these patterns, you almost wish you'd never seen them, right? Because then you have to do something about it. And it's desperately uncomfortable to begin writing with your left hand if you're right-handed, right? I mean, that's what it can feel like to really address our own issues. So the wilderness is uncomfortable. At the same time, and I don't want to stretch this analogy too far, but I think there's part of us that longs for the wilderness, right, as human beings. I mean, why do we go camping? I mean, some of you here are probably thinking, yeah, good question. Why on earth would anybody go camping? I personally love camping because it brings me closer to a reality of some kind, being closer to the elements, being not having all those comforts. Somehow, I feel more human in those environments. I don't want to live there for my whole life, got to say. I like my comforts, but there's something compelling about it, and obviously there's a whole industry out there of the wilderness experience, right? So there is something alluring about it too, and likewise, I think we long to be real. We long to, in a way, be deconstructed, to kind of strip away some of those defense mechanisms so we can be our true selves, and we long for other people to be like that with us too, okay? So we're on this journey into the wilderness, and it's going to be uncomfortable. If it's not uncomfortable, I would say we're probably not in the wilderness. So let's embrace it, embrace the discomfort, if you like, knowing that we're about creating safe space. And that's the kind of second issue here, in this passage is that I think Lent often becomes, it can feel very unloving, right? It's a season of self-examination. It's kind of like, perhaps it's the season where we've always suspected God can't stand us, but Lent is 40 days where God really can just rail on us as being hopeless human beings, right? I mean, it can have that feel, and it's very self-deprecating, very, I'm just not good enough, I'm not this enough, I'm not that enough. And it can feel very disempowering. But we just read a passage there where the context of Jesus going into the wilderness is love, right? There's this voice that is heard, and you know, who heard it? Jesus seems to have heard it. Jesus seems to have seen things. In other versions of that story, it seems that everybody hears it. But what we see in that story is Jesus being loved. This is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. Now go into the wilderness, right? So it's the context is love. Jesus is in the wilderness in the context of love. And it's really important for us, I think, to grasp that and to keep that and cling to that as we go through Lent, because it's going to be very easy for us to be very unsafe with ourselves and beat ourselves up, maybe even be unsafe with other people and judge other people. We've got to remember that this is about love. And, I think, we've talked recently about how I think we project onto Jesus this sort of, Jesus was human, but really Jesus is a superhuman, special being, sort of God being. And of course God loves Jesus because Jesus was perfect and Jesus in every way, and I'm not. But maybe we can, again, think about Jesus in a different way. Maybe think about Jesus in terms of God's love as our champion, as one who embodied the love of God, who embraced God's love so fully that Jesus could say he and the Father are one. He is experiencing that oneness with God that we've been talking about a lot. So Jesus is kind of like an example. That's why we're following Jesus, because Jesus is saying you can have this too. And Jesus is a champion because Jesus is defending us against religion, defending us against everything that would rail against us and criticize us and put us down. And, you know, that sense of God is always watching. You know, that sort of feel that really came from the religious authorities of Jesus' time, or it was present. I mean, it's been present in religion ever since religion started. And we can be subject to that too. There's a fantastic passage in Luke, which we're going to read fairly, and we're not going to comment on it too much, but Luke portrays Jesus as a prophet, in fact, a prophet who sort of comes against religious authority and against religious abuse and against all the toxicity of religion, and ends up paying the price for doing that because religion kills him in the end. And Luke is portraying Jesus in that way in which the prophets came before Jesus. And so he has Jesus acting very much like a prophet. And here's one of those stories where Jesus is. I think we could read this story as Jesus is advocating for us. He's advocating for people who may feel weighed down and oppressed by religion and feel bad about themselves and feel nitpicked and all the rest of it. Here's what Jesus says. Here's what happens. When Jesus had finished speaking, a Pharisee invited him to eat with him. Big mistake, inviting Jesus around for dinner. So he went in and reclined at the table. But the Pharisee was surprised when he noticed that Jesus did not first wash before the meal. That's the traditional ritual washings that Jesus should have performed as a religious person. Then the Lord said to him, Now then, you Pharisees clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness. So it's like, whoa, Jesus is kind of getting pretty riled up here. I think this is the closest we get to Jesus totally losing it and kind of using bad language and all the rest of it, right? Of course, Jesus wouldn't do that. But you can tell Jesus is pretty mad at this point. You foolish people, did not the one who made the outside make the inside also? But now, as for what is inside you, be generous to the poor, and everything will be clean for you. And then he goes on to six woes, right? So the woe oracles are classic prophetic forms that, you know, literary forms that were used in the Hebrew scriptures. And Jesus kind of goes into prophetic mode, or at least what he says is being related to us in that sort of prophetic mode. And there's six of them. First three are for the Pharisees. Woe to you Pharisees, because you give a tenth of your mint, rue, and all kinds of garden herbs, but you neglect justice and the love of God. You should have practiced the latter without leaving the former undone. Woe to you Pharisees, second one, because you love the most important seats in the synagogues and respectful greetings in the marketplaces. Woe to you because you are like unmarked graves which people walk over without knowing it. In other words, there's some cultural connotations there, but you're setting traps for people all the time. You're trying to trip people up. Now, so there's other people there. So that's the Pharisees. There's other people there, the experts in the law. And they were like, wait a second. One of the experts in the law answered, "Teacher, when you say these things, you insult us also," which is a cue for Jesus just to tone it down a little bit and say, "Oh, I didn't mean you guys. It's just the Pharisees over here." But what he does, Jesus replied, "And you experts in the law, woe to you, because you load people down with burdens they can hardly carry, and you yourselves will not lift one finger to help them." I think that's the key phrase in all this. You weigh people down, but you don't lift a finger to help people. "Woe to you, because you build tombs for the prophets, and it was your ancestors who killed them. So you testify that you approve of what your ancestors did. They killed the prophets, and you build their tombs. Because of this, God, in his wisdom, said, 'I will send them prophets and apostles, some of whom they will kill, and others they will persecute.' Therefore, this generation," this is strong language, "this generation will be held responsible for the blood of all the prophets that has been shed since the beginning of the world." I mean, there's a lot of hyperbole here. "From the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah." I mean, he's taken the whole of the Hebrew scripture there. "Who was killed between the altar and the sanctuary. Yes, I tell you, this generation will be held responsible for it all. Woe to you experts in the law," final woe, "because you have taken away the key to knowledge. You yourselves have not entered." I think he's talking about wisdom and the love of God here. "You have not entered, and you have hindered those who were entering." So you've not entered into this experience of God that is available for everybody, but you've kept other people out. "When Jesus went outside, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law began to oppose him fiercely and to besiege him with questions." Okay, that's the end, I think. Sorry. "To besiege him with questions." They're trying to catch him out. They're plotting to kill him, right? So, and you can understand why. So we spent a little bit of time on that passage because I think that it's just an indication of how huge that is. Going into Lent in the context of love is so important for us. If Jesus is railing on anything, he's railing on religion. He's railing on judgment and the sort of oppression of religion, right? So I think what we can take from that is a couple of things. As we go into some of these uncomfortable challenges, let's not judge ourselves. Let's not judge others. And also, as we go into these uncomfortable situations, let's look for how we can help one another and support one another. That's going to come out time and time again throughout this series, that this isn't something we do alone, right? Some of these challenges we're taking on, we can help one another with those. And some of that's going to be through friendships. Some of that's going to be through groups. We'll talk about that in a second. Some of the groups that we'll be starting during this Lent season. But we're not on our own. Let's contrast Jesus there, sort of addressing the way of religion, with the Jesus way. And this is a very familiar passage to us from Matthew chapter 11. "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened." So this is the tone of Lent we're going to take on, okay? When we think about Jesus as an advocate, a champion. "Come to me, all who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." If we're feeling weighed down, if we're feeling the pressure, if we're feeling under the gun, if we're just struggling, and we're struggling to feel God's love, we're struggling to experience that oneness with God that Jesus talks about, Jesus is saying, "Hey, I'm going to help you. Come alongside me. Let's do this together." The same passage in the Message, I think, you know, kind of brings out, a modern translation brings that out more graphically somehow, I think. "Are you tired, worn out, burned out on religion? Come to me, get away with me, and you'll recover your life. I'll show you how to take a real rest. Walk with me and work with me. Watch how I do it. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace. I won't lay anything heavy or ill-fitting on you. Keep company with me, and you'll learn to live freely and lightly." Such a beautiful invitation. So that's what we're going to endeavor to do through this series. Now, a couple of issues that I think, again, issues that will be important for us going through this whole series are the issues of acceptance and vulnerability, right? So can we, to create safe space, those are core issues. Can we create an atmosphere of acceptance, not judgment, but acceptance, in which it's then possible to be vulnerable, to be open? And as we are vulnerable, as we are open with our lives, that itself becomes an invitation to others to be vulnerable, to be vulnerable themselves, right? So it's these two things, are acceptance and vulnerability, are very closely connected issues, and we need that. We need to create space around us for others for that, but we also need to accept ourselves and be vulnerable with ourselves, have compassion on ourselves. And that means doing some of that inner work that we were talking about earlier, which may feel uncomfortable, but it's worth the journey. Now, as we think about that inner work, one of the key issues, it seems, when it comes to acceptance and vulnerability, is the constant commentary going on in our heads, right? And we all have it, right? We all have like a commentary going on. You've probably had it this morning. You'd be thinking, oh, Matthew's speaking. I thought it was going to be Ruth this morning. Oh, bummer. Or maybe it's like, hey, interesting lights. Oh, I haven't seen those lights before. Or did he have that shirt on last week? Was it? Oh, shirt. Oh, I didn't pick up the dry cleaning. Oh my gosh, I didn't pick it. You know, so it can be stuff like that, right? We've all had that probably going on this morning, in between paying close attention to what's been said. But we have that gift of doing both somehow. But sometimes it can be more sinister, right? It can be, oh no, I forgot the dry cleaning. My daughter's going to be mad at me. What am I going to do? Oh, and we start judging ourselves. And it's sort of like, seems like it's us. That voice seems like it's our voice. It's kind of our persona in some ways. But we also have arguments with ourselves. No, she won't be mad at me because she loves me. You know, so how many people are there up there, right? So these things, this commentary, in some sense, it's real to us in that it's present, but it's not necessarily us. It's just thoughts and comments and commentary on life. And it can actually lead us into some very destructive places, right? Because, by the way, I don't pick up dry cleaning, and I can't ever remember my daughter getting mad at me about dry cleaning, but I'm using it as an example. You know, I might feel I've upset somebody like my daughter over a particular issue, and then while I'm talking to her, that voice is going along saying, you better fix this problem. She's upset about something. You've got to fix it. When actually, that's not my place to do it. You know, so it's not my place to fix it. I might not be able to fix it. Or I might be telling myself that she's mad at me when she's not mad at me. You know, and all these sort of things start working away. And then I get defensive. And then I get this, that, and the other. You know, and this commentary can be really unhelpful to us. It's not the only challenge, right? There are many other challenges, but it's a bit of a challenge. So we're going to just practice just for a few minutes here, attempting to turn that commentary off. And we've done this before. It's through something we call centering prayer, and we'll practice that. We'll do a little bit more of this next week, and there will be opportunities in the various groups to practice some centering prayer as well. The basic premise is this: that it's almost impossible to think about nothing, right? I don't know if you've ever tried it. It's just not that easy. So with a practice and a technique, we find that we can begin to get better at turning that voice off. And we do it intentionally at certain times when we're, you know, more focused, so that throughout the rest of our lives, perhaps that voice just gets sort of damped down a bit. Those thoughts aren't so dominating for us. And centering prayer is basically an opportunity for us in silence and usually solitude, not always, because we're not in solitude right now, to focus in on letting go of those thoughts, right? Those thoughts are going to come. They're just there, right? Because we've practiced those. I've been practicing that for 52 years, probably. I'm sure I was doing that as a baby, fretting about something. That's well ingrained, right? So those thoughts are just going to come. So we're not going to beat ourselves up about that. They're going to be there. But what we will do is just let them go. And, you know, it's a little bit like, some people have used this analogy, it's like just sort of dropping them like a leaf you're sat in front of a stream or a river, and we're just going to let those thoughts just drop on the river and float down, float away from us. We're not going to try and go after them. We're not going to think about them. We're not going to process them or rationalize them or anything like that. We're just going to let them go. So as we have in a second here, a moment of silence, we'll let those thoughts go. But it will also be tricky to not get end up thinking, have I let that thought go? Oh, you know, and we get distracted and start doing all that thinking again. So the technique is one of return, to just return back to a center of letting go of those thoughts, right? So it's almost like centering prayer is just a constant state of returning, because we inevitably get distracted. And that's okay. The point is not how great we were at practicing this, so much as did we just return? Did we return to a center? Now, the way we return to a center is a lot of people use what they call a sacred word, right? It's important to remember the word we choose is not important. This is not a meditation on a word. So you might choose a nice fancy religious word like faith or something like that. You might just as well choose rabbit, because or baked beans or something like that. But the point being, all you're going to do is use that word to remind yourself, oh, I remember my word when I've got distracted, and it will return me to a center. Some people, and actually I personally do this, would just return to your breathing, right? Breathing is another way of returning, another way of just coming, focusing back on your breathing. And part of that is because I sometimes find the word distracting, right? You know, because my word, if it's got a religious connotation, I start thinking about that. If it's baked beans, I start thinking about baked beans, right? So sometimes breathing can help. But either way, you might find it's helpful to have a word or to have some breathing. We just remember our word, and then we return to that center. So we're just going to spend, I'm going to time us here for 3 minutes. And that, for some, that might seem very, very brief, and so for some, it's going to seem like an eternity. And what we'll do, I'm going to be sat with all of us facing forward, but you sit in a comfortable, physically neutral position. There's nothing, no secret to why that is. It's simply so, you know, you're sat in a way that your body won't distract you, because you've got an ache or a pain or an arm going numb or something like that. Just sit in a very comfortable position. Takes, as we've done many times here, just take some deep breaths, just a couple of deep breaths, and then focus in on your breathing. And then either remain focused on your breathing or choose a word, and then just let those thoughts go. And when you get distracted, say your word and come back to that center, or center again on your breathing, and just keep returning. Well, let's do 3 minutes of that. was about 3 minutes. Not sure if it was exactly, so I got a bit distracted. but we won't do this now, but maybe afterwards you could chat with somebody next to you or somebody chatting with over coffee about what that was like. You know, did that feel like a long time? Was that a short time? Did that feel natural? Did that feel easy to do? Was it difficult? Did you find yourself wanting more time in that place? Or were you kind of just waiting for it to get over? And we'll practice that again next week. And on our website, there's information about other prayer practices like that that I think can help us as we do that inner work. Help us get more in touch with this ocean of love, with this God of the universe who is love. As we think about Jesus, you know, being the champion of that and the advocate of that and the embodiment of that, these practices can help us experience it in a very real, very very personal way. We're going to do another one now, and then we'll go into a time of communion. But this one we're going to sing together, right? And Caroline's going to come up in a second and lead us. And we're just going to sing a very simple song. It's the song we sang at the Ash Wednesday service, the refrain. And there's this, at the end of that passage we just read in Mark where Jesus is tempted. In Mark's version, there's a beautiful little sort of almost throwaway comment, and it says that Jesus was, he was tempted, and then he was with the animals, the wild animals and the angels. And there's this sense of oneness, like Jesus was in this place of oneness because, he's with the angels, so it's kind of like this heavenly realm, this earthly realm is one. He's with the wild animals. And there's something really beautiful about that because those animals are wild, and it's the wilderness, right? But there's this peace and connectedness that is described there in that phrase in Mark. And it, to me, that conjures up this sense of God is love. God is all love. And there's a psalm, we'll just take a quick look at that. We looked at a few weeks ago, actually, just a couple of verses from it, which says, "The eyes of all look to you." And as we said before, contemplation means to gaze upon. Okay, so there's this acknowledgement that the eyes of all look to you, and you give them their food at the proper time. You open your hand and satisfy the desires of every living thing. So as we think about how, we may want to switch off our thoughts, that can perhaps even feel like a negative thing. We're trying to stop doing something. But that gives us space to do something positive, which is to gaze upon love, to gaze upon God, to gaze upon our oneness with God, to gaze upon our oneness with all things. And that is where our desires will be satisfied. That's where contentment, that's where safety is found. That's where our hungers and thirsts are truly satisfied and met. So we're going to sing the song again. Let's stay seated. We'll put the lights down a little bit. This is sort of a meditative time. We're going to sing, it's just a few lines long, and we're going to sing it several times over. And I encourage you, just kind of sink into the song. After a while, you better have your eyes closed because the words are very easy. Just sink into it and kind of be in it. Just be in it. And let's see what happens as we do that, as we make that connection with God.
The eyes of all look to you. The eyes of all look to you, O God, and you satisfy.
Communion in just a moment. Before we do that, I just wanted to point you to a handout on the welcome desk out in the Commons, which explains some of the things we're going to be doing throughout this series. We've got a fox is our kind of icon for the series.